Okay, we are live in the Bergino Baseball Clubhouse at 67 East 11th Street in the landmark cast iron building, Greenwich Village, City of New York. Tonight we will start as we always do. To those of you who are here for the first time, welcome. To those who have been to the clubhouse before, welcome home. Tonight's author, Harvey Arradin, had me at hello, and I'll explain that in a moment. But first, just for those of you, most of the people here, I think, know Harvey quite well, know of Harvey quite, from an amazing career. But for those, some of the people listening on our podcast may not, so just a quick bio. Harvey Arradin joined the New York Times as a sports reporter in 1991 and became a national columnist in 1993. He is the author of many books, including When the Garden Was Eden, Clyde, the Captain, Dollar Bill, and the Glory Days of the New York Knicks. His work has also appeared in the New York Times Magazine, the New York Times Book Review, ESPN, the Daily News, and the New York Post. And it's an honor to have Harvey with us tonight in the clubhouse.
Thrilled to be here.
Thank you. The reason I said Harvey had me at hello, it's a couple things. The New York Times sports columnists, those are legendary writers. Red Smith, Dave Anderson, George Bessie, who was here in December. Many of you were here for that. Ira Burkow, Harvey Arradin. And that's the Hall of Fame of writers. So it's when I read Harvey's article, which came out just over a year ago, many of you may have read this, when it was called For Barrett and Guidry, It Happens Every Spring. When I got to the end of it, I got emotional. And I didn't quite know why at that moment, although, as my wife Marcy can attest, I am emotional. But you don't get emotional over a quote-unquote baseball story. But baseball stories are not baseball stories, per se. And then I realized this column, well, when I read the book, I realized that, with all due respect to Eric Siegel, Harvey wrote a love story. At least that's how I read it. And I think it's a beautiful, sweet love story. And when I started the book, which usually it takes me a while to get through these things, but this one I devoured. And Harvey got me up in the with a dedication to the memory of Gilbert Arradin, my father, and Morris Finkelstein, my uncle, who both took me to see Yogi Berra and the Yankees play for the first time in 1962. And you beat me by a year. My dad took me for the first time in 1963. So we're going to do something that there's a first time for everything. As many of you know, we just like to have baseball discussions. We have intense, enjoyable discussions, and then we open it up for questions. Tonight, though, we're going to do it a little bit different to start. Harvey's actually going to read the prologue. I think it's a nice way to start off, as prologues are. So, thanks, Harvey.
Don't worry, it's short. It was interesting, because I really wasn't sure how to start this book. As Jay said, it grew out of a story that I wrote for the Times in February of 2011. And I'll just mention briefly.
Absolutely. The book. Absolutely.
I live in Montclair, New Jersey, which is Yogi Berra's town. They might as well rename the town Berraville, because so much of the town's identity is somehow entwined with Yogi living there. And he raised his kids there. They went to Montclair High School. And in 1999, they opened a museum. They called it the Yogi Museum and Learning Center. On the campus of Montclair State University. And it was a group called the Friends of Yogi. They built a small baseball stadium that the university uses, but they also have a minor league, well, an independent league team called the Jackals, which plays its home games there. And they built the museum in conjunction with that. And they do a lot of children's programs. Quick funny story that when I was, they have these t-shirts that say Yogi Berra Museum and Learning Center. So one day about 3 or 4 years ago, I was up in Boston with my wife. We were on vacation. And I was riding the T going one place or another. And some guy gets on the T and gets in our car and looks at me, and he points to my T-shirt and he goes, in one of these thick Boston accents, "Yogi Berra Learning Center, that's a joke, right?" And you know, he thought it was sort of a T-shirt like Yankee Suck or... So I said, no, there's really a Yogi Berra Museum and Learning Center. And so anyway, the director of the Museum and Learning Center is a man named Dave Kaplan, who's a former colleague of mine in the years that I worked at the Daily News. And Dave and I have been friends for a long time. His wife and my wife are very close friends. And about a year ago, February, my 14-year-old black Labrador died. And this was the first dog I ever had. So, and the dog that raised my children, so to speak. And so my wife and I were heartbroken. So Dave and his wife suggested on a Sunday night that we go out to dinner just to get out of the house. And so during the course of the conversation, I mentioned to Dave, "Hey, I'm going down to spring training next week. And so I'll be in Tampa." And I said, "You know, when is Yogi going down?" Because I always knew that Yogi goes down to spring training. And he said, "Oh, he's going down the week after." And I said, "Oh," and then I knew that Yogi the previous summer had taken a very bad fall outside his house, and he had missed it was right after George Steinbrenner had passed away, and so he missed Old Timers Day, which he always loved to go to, and also the Hall of Fame induction ceremony weekend in Cooperstown, which is also among his favorite things to do. I asked Dave, when Yogi goes to spring training, does Carmen, who is his wife, does she go with him to make sure that, you know, he's okay? Because, you know, he moves much slower than before, and, you know, not speaking, not projecting as much. And so he said, "Well, you know, it's kind of an interesting story that no one's ever done or no one's ever talked about." I said, "What's that?" He said, "Ron Guidry is Yogi's constant companion and his chauffeur, and they're like, they have this, you know, simpatico relationship that's really amazing." And in fact, one of the women who works at the museum, a couple of years into this friendship, even made a little cap for Guidry, and it says "Driving Mr. Yogi" on it. And Guidry, as we call him, Gator, wears it everywhere. Wears it when they play golf. He wears it out to dinner. And he has carved his identity as Yogi's chauffeur and his constant companion. And I thought to myself, well, it's kind of interesting. But I didn't think about doing a story. But on the way home that night, it hit me. You know, spring training, a pitcher, a catcher, a Hall of Fame, American icon, and one of the great Yankee pitchers of all time. You know, what a cool story. What a cool spring training story. It would be the essence of spring training. So the next day, or the day before I went to Florida, I went up to the museum and talked to Yogi about it. And, at this point, Yogi, he was never, let's put it, a loquacious man. And I always say he was like the original ESPN soundbite athlete, because Yogi's, his entire language was in, these little short takes. So I asked him a little bit about his relationship with Guidry, and he grunted a few. "Oh, he's a nice guy. And, we go out to dinner, and he makes frog legs, and I eat them." And that was about it. And then I called Carmen, and I asked her, and she said, "Oh, we love Gator. He's so sweet to Yogi. What he's done for Yogi over the years is so wonderful." So on with that, I went down to Tampa, and I waited for Guidry outside the coach's dressing room. And he came out, and I kind of knew him a little bit just from interviewing him from the 2 years that he was Joe Torre's pitching coach. But, I don't think he knew my name. And I really only knew him from being a crazy Yankee fan in the 70s and 80s before I became a sports columnist, and I had to kind of curb that stuff. So I asked him about the relationship with Yogi, and he immediately, his face tightened up, and he said, "That's kind of a personal thing between Yogi and I, and I really don't want to talk about it because it's a very special relationship to me." And right away, I started to, my heart sank a little bit, because I kind of knew this is kind of a cool story. So, chit-chatted for a minute, and then I said, I know Yogi's family. My kids, have grown up in Montclair. I've been to that museum many, many times. I was there the night that George came to for the museum to beg Yogi's forgiveness in 1999. And I did talk to Yogi about it. You know, I got two quotes from Yogi. And at that point, he relapsed and he said, "Hey, if Yogi's willing to talk about it, you know, that's fine with me. I'll talk about it as well." And that was the first sign that, to me, of Guidry's unending devotion to Yogi Berra. We talked for about 45 minutes to an hour, and I had the tape going. And even as he was telling me the stories about his relationship with Yogi, I was like, you know, getting goosebumps and almost listening as just another person being told these stories, not so much a reporter. Anyway, I went back to New York, did a couple other columns on other subjects down in Tampa, flew back to New York, told our photo desk that Yogi was flying down the next day, and if we could have a photographer to be at the airport or be at the gate when Yogi came off the plane, that would be great. So we did that. I wrote the story. The editors loved it. It was about 1,400 or 1,500 words, and it ran on page one of the paper. Not the sports page, but A1, because, you know, and the headline stuff like it happens every spring, because they got it. It was a great spring training tale. And the response to it was so overwhelmingly positive. And I don't mean just from Yankee fans, because we're a national newspaper, so we get email from all around the country and even the world. And we got email from, I remember one in particular that we printed in the paper the following Sunday. It was from a Red Sox fan who said something to the extent of, "I've hated the Yankees for every waking moment of my life, but for the 10 or 15 minutes that it took to read that story, I love the Yankees too." And so the natural thing to do seemed to be, after that, we started getting some calls from publishers, was to expand it into a book form. There was some other issues that had to be ironed out first, but here we are a year later. It was a pretty quick project. The publisher wanted to get it out this spring. And so, as I said before, I wasn't quite sure how to start it until Guidry kept calling me up and telling me stories of things that he'd forgotten to tell me. And here's just one story, but we led the prologue with a quote from Rich Gossage, Goose Gossage, and it says, "The one thing Yogi Berra and Ron Guidry have most in common and is obvious to everyone is that they are so unaffected by fame that you have to wonder if they even know that they were great players." Goose Gossage. So this is the prologue, and it's just about a page and a half. "Morning in Florida usually put Yogi Berra in the best of moods, but Ron Guidry could see right away that his old friend was cranky, not his usual sprightly self. Normally, Berra would be waiting for Guidry in front of his hotel, smiling and waving at the many well-wishers and fans until his ride to the park pulled up to the curb. But not this day, not this time. As Guidry approached, Berra was pacing, and Guidry could hear him through the open passenger side window mumbling under his breath, 'God damn son of a—' Guidry checked his watch to see if he was late, which was one of the few things that always made Berra grumpy. But no, he was actually a few minutes early. He leaned across the seat and pushed open the door. As Berra climbed into the truck, Guidry said, 'Yogi, what's the problem?' 'Ah, I just found out that I got to fly to L.A. Friday morning,' Berra said. 'L.A., Guidry said. 'What the hell for?' Guidry pulled away from the hotel out into traffic on the way to the Yankee spring training complex. Berra complained, 'I got to make an affliction commercial.' Guidry looked at him with bemusement, thinking, 'Is he doing something with some kind of hospital?' And then Berra said, 'You know, with that goddamn duck.' And then it struck Guidry what Berra was talking about. 'You mean the Aflac commercial?' He said, 'Yeah, Berra growled, but damn duck.' Guidry burst out laughing, couldn't stop, to the point where he had to pull over to the side of the road. He sat there for a minute, practically doubled over, red in face against the wheel. And then, out of the corner of his eye, he looked over at Berra, who was laughing at himself, suddenly on his own joke. Guidry shook his head and thought, 'Anytime you can share a laugh like that with this man, it's a great moment.'" That's...
It's a beautiful prologue, and the story of how the story came about is fascinating. if you can take us back to maybe how Yogi and Guidry, how their relationship first started, not from this part of the story, but from maybe 30 years ago or
sure.
so.
Well, I kind of divide the relationship into two parts. The first part is when, which is really a mentorship. When Guidry was a young player coming through the Yankee system in the early to mid-70s, now, of course, those of you who have followed the Yankees all these years know that it was like, it could be a living nightmare for any young player, but specifically a pitcher, to come through the Yankee system and actually stick with the major league team. And it was no different for Guidry. I mean, he was bounced up and down between Syracuse and New York. And it seemed that every time he came up to the Yankees, they were playing the Red Sox. And he would serve up a home run to Yastrzemski or, you know, be in the middle of something bad. And Steinbrenner would not only send him back down to Syracuse, which was the Columbus before Columbus was Columbus, but he would also demand that Gabe Paul, who was the general manager, trade him. It got to the point where Guidry was sent down to Syracuse once and actually he wanted to finally get an audience with Steinbrenner. So he called Steinbrenner's office and left a message and never heard back from him. So he just got in his car with his wife, Bonnie, and started driving back to Louisiana. He's from the Cajun country right around Lafayette. And finally, Bonnie said to him, or somewhere around Allentown, said to him, "You really going to go through with this?" And he said, "You know, I just can't take it anymore. You know, she was pregnant with their first child. You know, I'm going to whine." He was already, you know, 24, 25. And he was thinking, "I'm not going to be 30 years old with two kids and have no career. I can't let this thing go on." And she finally said a couple of other things to him. And he said something like, "Well, if you're willing to deal with this, you know, then we'll give it another shot." And she said, "I'm willing to deal with it. It's what you can't let them defeat you this way." So he turned around and he reported to Syracuse. And then he finally got to the Yankees in 76, 77. And they are now back from their two-year hiatus to Shea Stadium, back at the remodeled Yankee Stadium. And it turns out that Guidry's dressing stall is right next door to Yogi Berra's. A little bit of background on Guidry as a young baseball fan. He grew up in Louisiana, as I said. But remember, in that part of the country in the 1950s, early 60s, there was no baseball team. So I guess the Houston Colt 45s/Astros eventually. But his mother was a huge Yankees fan. So when Ron is an only child back at that point, used to sit, you know, whenever there was a national game on national television or the World Series, Ron would sit on the couch with his mother and root for the Yankees. So the names Berra, Mantle, Howard, Ford, they meant something to this guy, to this young guy from Louisiana. And so as he's, you know, trying to settle in with the Yankees, he's sitting next to Yogi Berra. Now again, Yogi's not a guy who says a lot. And Guidry desperately wants his attention. So he keeps throwing things out, just shooting little questions at him, you know, just trying to get him to acknowledge him and maybe give him some tips. And finally, Yogi realizes what's going on. Yogi's a very astute baseball guy. And he takes Guidry under his wing. And he imparts, you know, the Yogi-isms and Yogi's, you know, his MO, of course, is don't think too much. So it sounds kind of simple, right? But what could be better advice for a young pitcher trying to come up in the Yankee organization and stick with Steinbrenner's team than to not think too much? Just go out and do what you do. You have two pitches. You have a slider. You have a fastball. Until a guy proves that he can hit your slider, you know, keep throwing it. If he can hit your slider, throw your fastball. So this goes on, and Guidry begins to pester Yogi for more and more information, and they develop this rapport. And of course, Yogi remains a coach into the 80s until his turn comes to manage. And then he manages Ron for a season and a handful of games into the 85 season, when of course, as we all know, George fires him after promising that he would be the manager for the entire year. And not only does he fire him after a Sunday series, a Sunday game in Chicago's Comiskey Park, he fires him through an intermediary, the general manager, Clyde King. Doesn't pick up the phone and say, Yogi, no, it's Yogi Berra. You know, he's 10 World Series rings, he's a Hall of Famer. So that's where Yogi vows never to go back to Yankee Stadium for as long as George Steinbrenner owns the team. So Yogi, but a typical Yogi, his son was on the team. Dale Berra was on the Yankees that year. The team is leaving for the airport, and Yogi, in his own, you know, wisdom, says, why the hell should I take a taxi to the airport when the bus is going there too? So Yogi gets, he's just gotten fired, but he gets on the bus and he sits down in his manager's seat. And meanwhile, the players are stunned. Many of them are angry. Don Baylor had kicked over a garbage can. Mattingly was furious because he loved Yogi. Yogi helped discover him in the minor leagues. Dale Bear is sitting there in tears. And Yogi, the bus comes to the terminal where Yogi's going to get off, which is the terminal before the team was going to get off. And Yogi stands up and looks at the players and says, don't worry about me. I'll be on the golf course tomorrow back home. I want you to wear your uniform with pride. You're still Yankees. I love you all. I appreciate what you've done for me. And play hard for Billy Martin. And gets off the bus to a round of applause from the players. So this is Ron Guidry's relationship with Yogi Berra, what I call the mentorship part. So for the next 14 years, while Yogi refuses to go back to the stadium, Guidry occasionally sees him at, you know, a golf outing, a card signing show, things of that nature. But it's, you know, basically still, you know, Yogi's the mentor and Ron's the disciple. But when George comes to the museum to apologize, within several months, Yogi decides, okay, I'm going to go back to spring training. Now, just for some context, the Yankees at that point had relocated from Fort Lauderdale to Tampa. So a lot of the familiar surroundings that Yogi knew were gone. Joe Torre was the manager, and he knew Joe. Joe, in fact, had tried to get him to come back several times, including after the 96, the first World Series, when they beat the Braves. Joe had begged Yogi to come give out the championship rings the next season, but Yogi said, no, can't go. So now we're in, I think it was 2000, when he finally goes back to spring training as an instructor. So Guidry realizes that, hey, Yogi's coming in. You know, a lot of these people really don't know him. They've never been around him. So Guidry calls up the museum and says, tell Yogi I'll pick him up at the airport. And he picks him up, and he takes him to the hotel, and he sees that Yogi's a little out of sorts. Now remember, this is a man now in his mid-70s already. And he says to him, hey, Yogi, what are you doing for dinner tonight? You got plans?
No, I got no plans.
Oh, I got a place down the street. I think it was a seafood restaurant. So why don't I pick you up at 6 o'clock? We'll go have some supper, as Ron calls it. So they have dinner. And once you start doing something with Yogi, once it becomes even once, twice, three times, you have to do it all the time. And they developed this routine where they started going out to dinner every night. They had a rotation, of 5 restaurants that they would just keep going to over and over. And it just became part of the routine. And then Ron would pick up Yogi. Yogi likes to be at the ballpark at the crack of dawn. Ron didn't have to be there as a guest instructor that early, but he knew Yogi wanted to. So he would pick him up first thing in the morning, and this relationship began to evolve from mentorship to friendship, and ultimately over the course of 12, 13 years, to really something which I called really a love story.
If we can maybe touch on some of the things that you touched on, and I don't want to run out of time, so I'm going to kind of jump right ahead to something that I always truly admired Yogi for. With all, I must admit, I am a Mets fan. So when he just refused to go back to Yankee Stadium because of what Steinbrenner did to him, if you could take us back a little bit to that time when Steinbrenner comes to the museum and is trying to get Yogi finally to come back.
Yeah. Well, you know, There were times during the 14 years where Carmen and at least one or two of his three sons would try to get him to go back. You know, besides people like Joe Torre and some others, you know, other former players. But Yogi's pretty, not only principled, but also stubborn. And, of course, the older you get, maybe the more stubborn you get, you know. My sons have accused me of that. So Yogi was resolute. I mean, he wouldn't go back. Now the museum opens, and Susan Waldman, who's at that time was a reporter for WFAN, covered the Yankees. Now, Susan had always had a good relationship with George. And in fact, when George was suspended in the early 90s for the Dave Winfield fiasco, when he came back, he granted Susan the first interview and did a show with her for like 2 hours, which I heard after he died, she replayed it on WFAN, and it was great. It was really, I mean, George was wonderful. But anyway, Susan decided that she wanted to have a show at the museum. She really didn't know Yogi very much. But she figured, let me do one of her shows. She used to do like shows as sort of like when Mike Francesa, or I think it was a night show. So there was no regular night host in those days because they always had games on. But on the night of an off night or a rain out, she would do these shows. So she decided to see if they would let her do a show up at the museum. And originally it was going to be an anniversary show for the Mets. I guess it was going to be a show, I think, for the Mets' the Mets' pennant-winning team that Yogi managed.
73.
Right. I guess it was close enough to the anniversary.
Right.
So, 25th anniversary. So, that was going to be the show. And then one of her producers at the station said, "Hey, maybe you can get George Steinbrenner to come and apologize to Yogi." And Susan said, "Yeah, right. Maybe I can get him to let me pitch opening day at the stadium next season." But then once she started thinking about it, she figured, you know, why not? I'll give it a shot. And she actually called George in Tampa, and he started to argue with her. You know, what am I supposed to do? You know, I'm going to come out there. You know, what if it's an ice storm? I can't land. And she's thinking to herself, I know George well enough so that if he doesn't want to do something, he's just going to slam the phone down, and that'll be the end of it. But if he argues with you, that means the thought is percolating. She also knew, she was also smart enough to know, that George is a very astute businessman. And back then, you know, Mickey Mantle had died. Joe DiMaggio was pretty much on his deathbed right around that period. And George, she was thinking, might be thinking that this would be an opportune time to get Yogi back in the fold. I mean, he would soon to be the greatest living Yankee, which is a significant, you know, unofficial title. But also, you know, it's a nice thing to do to have a guy who's as beloved as Yogi back around the team. All of a sudden, George agreed to do it. And so they set the date for the show. Unfortunately, the governor of Florida died on like 2 days before the show was supposed to happen. So they had to postpone it. George, being so much a part of Florida business and everything, had to go to the funeral. And so they rescheduled it for early January. And George comes up, and he gets picked up in a limousine by Rick Cerrone, not the catcher, the former catcher, but the former PR guy, spelled with two R's. And he told me in the chapter we did on this reunion that he'd never seen George so frightened and almost speechless in his time around the Yankees. He said it was almost as if like George was so much out of his element. He had to, this is a guy who's used to, you know, basically being in control of other people's lives. And suddenly he was going to Yogi and didn't know how Yogi really was going to respond. Because the truth of the matter is, when they first broached the subject with Yogi, Yogi said, hell no, he's not coming here, because he thought it was going to be a publicity stunt that he was going to have to participate in. But finally, Dale Barrett talked him into it, I think mainly by saying, you know, your grandchildren have never seen you in Yankee Stadium, and, you know, you'll never give them that pleasure. So finally, he agreed to do it, and he comes and he shows up, and Yogi's waiting outside, and George walks up and says, hi, Yogi. And Yogi looks at his watch and goes, you're late. He was 10 minutes late coming from Tampa. But that's Yogi Berra. I mean, if you are not exactly on time, I mean, as Carmen says in the book and in the story, that if Yogi's supposed to take medication, and he takes a lot of it these days, if Yogi's supposed to take medication at 5 o'clock, at 10 to 5, he's standing there looking at the bottle. Then Yogi was late. So this is Yogi, and this is the man who Guidry takes on, you know, as his constant companion in the spring. Not an easy chore, but one that, you know, Guidry did happily and lovingly.
And there's a couple of relationships that Yogi has otherwise that if you could just talk about a little bit. One that it always looks very interesting when you see them together, Yogi and Derek Jeter.
Yeah, well, Yogi, you know, one of the great things about when he went back to spring training that first time, they asked him to work with Posada, who had already become the starting catcher, although he had Girardi backing him up. But, you know, so Girardi was considered the more experienced and, you know, just, you know, a better catcher. But Posada was so much better hitter than Joe was, and that was the year that Girardi left to go play for the Cubs. So they wanted Yogi to see what he could do with Posada. So Yogi, of course, this was, you know, rejuvenating for Yogi. He couldn't wait. But, you know, the byproduct for Yogi was also that he really admired those Yankee teams. I mean, he used to constantly tell people, he didn't know the guys, but by watching them play, Jeter, Bernie, Posada, Paul O'Neill, Tino, Brocious, all these guys, they were, you know, they helped put a smile back on the face of the Yankee franchise. I mean, you know, George pretty much had destroyed the team's reputation in terms of the, you know, the way they did business, the way he operated, all the stuff that got him suspended. Around the mid-90s, you know, that team suddenly became an easy team to root for. And, of course, Joe Torre became the patriarch of New York sports. And Yogi, from afar, from his leather chair in his Montclair home, fell in love with this team. So the idea that he could actually spend time around these guys was, you know, was thrilling for him. And he developed this relationship first, you know, with Jeter, because, you know, Jeter's not an easy, I don't know if any of you have read Ian O'Connor's book, The Captain, but, you know, which I thought was an excellent book, Profile of Derek. But Jeter's not an easy person to get to know. I mean, you know, he almost lives, you know, he's a great teammate in terms of, except the A-Rod, but in terms of being a great team player and, you know, and do anything to win a game, but he sort of lives on an island in terms of his personal life. He keeps everyone at bay. But when Yogi came around, it kind of softened Jeter, because, you know, here's this guy. They had won 4 rings at that point. And here's this guy, you know, forgetting, you know, letting your heads get a little swollen. Here's this guy with 10. And he's just the guy, you know. Jeter always says that the key to his success as a personality in New York is keeping everything simple. You know, he's always very accommodating with the media, but he never says anything. And he just says to keep all the distractions out. You know, I just don't think about the other stuff too much. Well, of course, that's Yogi's MO as well. So the two of them kind of hit it off right from the start. And Yogi developed this great, you know, routine of whether it was spring training or at the stadium, where Yogi goes, because, again, he's such a creature of habit, he goes to the first game of every home series. unless, of course, there's a big event like Old Timers Day. And he makes the rounds, and he never fails to stop by Jeter's locker, where he just kibitzes with him. You know, he teases him about, you know, the number of rings that he has compared to Yogi. And, you know, when Jeter won his fifth, Jeter said to him, "Well, now we're even." And Yogi said, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "I got five." And Yogi said, "I got 10. And he said, "Yeah, but you never played in the playoffs. You went right to the World Series every year. So I think we're even." And Yogi flashed into it. "Two hands, Derek, two hands." So they have that kind of relationship. And, you know, he's managed to develop that kind of relationship with some of the other players as well. Rivera, Nick Swisher in particular, they have a very good relationship that we can talk about, you know, in a little bit if you'd like.
Okay. Well, I have plenty of other questions, but something tells me we may have some from our crowd. So, would anyone, Nick?
Harvey, I look forward to reading the book. I just really had a question. In terms of Yogi's baseball wisdom, obviously he can develop great chemistry. Were you able to observe some instances with some players, let's say last year's spring training, that he was able to impart, and what those specifically might be?
Well, because the book came out of my story in the Times, which was 2011 spring training, and the book had to be finished by October, late October, I actually didn't spend any time in spring training with him, so a lot of it is recreation from storytelling. But I was able to spend a significant amount of time around Ron and Yogi, seeing, because it was important to see how they interact. But the story I'll tell about Nick Swisher is that and this is a classic story about, I think it really sums up a lot of the relationship between Ron and Yogi. Last year, 2 years ago, in 2010, so it was the year after they won the World Series, they're down in spring training, and Swisher is having a tough time of it early in the exhibition season. And he's pounding a lot of balls into the dirt. He's rolling out to second and shortstop. So by this point, I mean, Yogi used to sit in the dugout in spring training, especially when Gibby was pitching coach, in the area where Joe Torre would sit. And Gibby was, you know, so Yogi would be next to Torre, Zimmer would be on the other side of Torre, and Gibby would be next to Yogi. But when Torre left, Yogi likes Girardi well enough, but, you know, it's kind of like the next generation, and Gidry was no longer pitching coach. He was just a guest instructor. So they kind of sat down at the other side of the dugout near the water cooler, and they were like, you know, those are buddies sitting there the whole game. So this one day, Swisher grounds out to second for like the third time in a row, because he had faced a similar pitcher the night before. And Yogi sits there and he looks at Gator and he says, "He's hitting over the ball. He's got to move. He's got to move up in the box. Or I should say, he's hitting under the ball. Well, whatever it was, that the breaking ball was breaking down, and he wasn't. So he was just nubbing it into the ground. And so Gator says to Yogi, "Why don't you tell him, not me?" And Yogi says, "Nah, he's got a coach. He's got a coach for that." So Gator is forever cognizant of not wanting Yogi. Now remember, this is like, he doesn't call it a father-son relationship only because Ron's father is still alive. So he always says this would be disrespectful to my father. But it operates in many respects that way. This was hurtful to Ron because he feels like he doesn't want Yogi to disconnect. You know, he feels that Yogi's pulling back and being unwilling to say something to a player the way he helped Gidry when he was a player. He feels that it helps keep Yogi alive, helps him keep him moving forward. Like we all have parents and grandparents, you know, and we'll all be there one day. Well, we want somebody to help us keep us connected to our identities, the things that define us, the things that keep us vital. So here comes Swisher down the dugout path toward the water cooler and stomping around, mumbling under his breath, And Guidry stands up and blocks his path and points at Yogi and says, he wants to talk to you. And Yogi's like, what? What? And so Swisher, being a sweetheart, as most of you probably know, he's a very outgoing guy, sits down next to Yogi. And Yogi says, you got to move up in a box, next box. This guy doesn't throw hard enough to bust it by you, so you'll be there and you'll get to the breaking ball early. So Nick says, okay, Yogi, I hear you. So Swisher goes up to the plate the next couple innings later. And whether he actually moved up in the box, nobody really knows. Well, on the first pitch, he smacks the ball into the gap for a double, stands on second, and does one of these to Yogi in the dugout. Now, of course, Yogi, by that point, is drifting off into his own space. I mean, you know, at that point, he's 85 years old, falls asleep on the bench a lot, you know. Guidry gives him an elbow to the ribs and says, he's trying to say something to you. And so Swisher's doing this, and then he scores a couple of minutes later, and he comes back to the bench, sits down next to Yogi, puts his arm around him, says, tell me more. And since that time, and you know, again, coincidence or not, Swisher had one of his best statistical seasons in 2010. And the upshot is that the two of them form this relationship where now Nick calls Yogi my surrogate his grandfather who had raised him, because his parents divorced and his father was a ball player. So his grandfather and grandmother raised him in, I think it's Parkersburg, West Virginia. And so his grandfather had passed away like the year before. And so he cultivated this relationship with Yogi to the point where he now calls him my surrogate grandfather. So that's like a primary example of not only of how Yogi, you know, still can get his message across, but also the way Guidry helps him do it, you know, to kind of keep him, as I said, connected to the things that, you know, keep him moving forward and to not give up the things that he loves.
Actually, before we take the next question, I have a question I want to make sure we get in. We've been talking about what Yogi means to this crop of players. If we can just go back to Yogi as a very young ball player with the great Bill Dickey, the catcher, what that relationship was.
Well, you know, when Yogi went to spring training that first time to work with Posada, he did make a point of telling him about how he was a terrible catcher when he first came up. You know, Yogi's not a, when you look at him, doesn't look like a classic athlete. I mean, now, of course, he's lost a couple of inches, but even then, people used to make fun of him, you know, almost to the point of being cruel. But Bill Dickey had come back as a coach and basically worked with Yogi. And as Yogi, you know, one of his famous expressions is that, or his lines about that was that Dickey learned me his experience. And so, you know, the thing about Yogi is the linkage of generations, of Yankees generations, is very important to him. And so he obviously was, even though he was too stubborn and proud to go back to the stadium for those 14 years, he obviously couldn't wait to get there when he finally did settle up with George, because he saw an opportunity for him to help one of the younger players to do for Posada what Dickey had done for him. You know, those people who know Yogi, and this is the beauty of him, you know, it's... I talk to a lot of people, you know, who are sort of inside his circle, and they could be somebody as rich and famous as Derek Jeter, or, you know, the hairdresser and manicurist he goes to get his hair cut and nails done. And yes, Yogi gets his nails done before big events like Alzheimer's Day. You know, somebody like that. It doesn't matter as long as you earn his trust and loyalty, and you're someone he can rely on. So, those things really matter to him, the linkage of generations and he's really proud of the work that he did with Posada. It really was, just quickly, when Posada had that thing with the Yankees last season where he took himself out of the lineup before a nationally televised game against the Red Sox and caught holy hell from the organization for it. The next day, Yogi made it a point to show up at the ballpark just to go talk to Posada and just, you know, he didn't say, Yogi's not, again, not a real verbal guy. He's not going to say, oh, you know, you're great, this and that. Just to get one over and gave him a little nudge with the elbow, a little pat on the back, just to say, I'm here for you. And those are the things that are important to Yogi.
Yogi cared about his linkage to Yankee history. Why did he take a job as a coach with the Houston Astros?
Well, because this was after he was fired by the Yankees, and he made his vow that he would never go back to Yankee Stadium. At the time, let's say Yogi in 1985, if he's 80, turning 87 next month, so in 85 he would have been 27 years, he would have been only 60. And at that point, his kids were all either grown or in college, or playing baseball, they're out of the house. And he was very good friends with McMullen, the owner of the Astros, who was also at one point a minority, very small minority owner with the Yankees. And McMullen is a Montclair resident. And he talked Yogi into going down and being a coach with the Astros, just because Yogi still really wanted to be involved with baseball. Just like in the 60s, after the Yankees fired him, he became coach on Gil Hodges' staff and actually became manager when Hodges died suddenly of a heart attack.
Harvey, can you tell us one of my favorite stories? As you were just talking about Yogi being fired in 64 by the Yankees, was the Phil Lynn's incident on the bus in Veronica. Right. I didn't know if you had any insight on that. That was a great story with Mantle, and telling Lynn's to play it louder, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, the Yankees were struggling. I think, as I recall it, the Yankees were struggling at that point in the season. And, you know, they were a bunch of characters. They were also, they were coming to the end of the road as a dynastic team. And supposedly, some of the guys like Mantle, more the cut-ups and Ford, were encouraging him to play the harmonica. And at a certain point, Yogi had had enough and stood up and, told him to, put the damn harmonica down. But, I always thought that, that Yogi's, especially, today when we see him as an older man, and, for a long time he's seen as this cuddly character with this, with this cartoonish nickname. But, so it's hard to imagine him as this really, serious and committed competitor. But that brought that out in him. And to me, that was an illustration of what it was that made Yogi great. I mean, he, clearly was, a classic overachiever in that he didn't have, he had quick bat and, he has incredibly strong hands that Guidry talks about in the book. But, he just was a guy who lived to compete. To me, that's what I take out of that story. I don't know as much about the details. We didn't really cover that much in the book about, Yogi's first go-around as manager.
Any other, Wayne?
Two quick hits. One was, I think this is related to Pizzuto. And the other, speaking more to his experience as a manager, because he wasn't successful. And, where his strengths and weaknesses should he have ever been?
Well, I'll take the second part first. I mean, the question about whether he was successful or not, I think, is somewhat debatable. I mean, because you know, his first year managing the Yankees in 64, they won 100 games, and, you know, they recovered from that, the episode with Lins, and they went to the World Series and lost to the Cardinals in Game 7. They lost to Bob Gibson. And Ford was actually hurt in that series, and he wound up pitching Mel Stottlemyre, who was a rookie, three games head-to-head against Gibson. So he fell one victory short. Ralph Houk was said to have some resentment of Yogi, the attention he got, the fact that Yogi was considered an icon, and, you know, they pulled this crazy stunt where as soon as the season ended, they fired Yogi and they hired the man who beat him in the World Series, Johnny Keene. A lot of people felt that it was sort of like the Yankees got their comeuppance because they wound up finishing sixth in 65, and that pretty much, you know, was the end of the dynasty. So you could look at Yogi's first go-around as manager, that he actually, you know, got the most out of a team that was really on its last legs and just happened to come up one game short. With the Mets, you know, he had 3 years as manager, thereabouts. You know, they did have, they weren't a great team that year. They kind of snuck in. They won the division with a barely over 500, and lost to the Oakland A's, you know, which is, again, a dynastic team. So he had some success. The team in the 80s, and this is where, you know, the players, mainly Guidry in the book, but some others, defended him as saying, you know, after 81, which was the strike year, where the Yankees did get to the World Series, it was that strange year where they had the winner of the first half and the winner of the second half, but lost to the Dodgers. After 81, what manager did have real success? That was a team that that was always lacking in pitching. You know, right through the 80s, they had great hitting. They had Mattingly, they had Winfield, they had Baylor, they had Henderson, they had Jack Clark. But George was always doing crazy things like trading young pitchers like Doug Drabeck and bringing in guys like, you know, who was the lefty now? He brought in... He traded Jay Buhner for Ken Phelps. But he also traded for a pitcher, and he told Lou Piniella famously, "I just won you the pennant," Steve Trout. You know, and, you know, they had guys like Joe Niekro and Phil Niekro, and Joe Cowley pitched an elimination game at the end of the season when they did manage to stay in the race. So Yogi managed within that time frame, and they had a winning season. They just didn't win enough, and they got off to a shaky start in 85. I think they were like, I don't know, 6-8 or something like that, and he got fired. So I really do think that, you know, the jury was out on him. He was a guy who occasionally would leave you scratching your head, you know, with some of his strategy. Guidry tells a funny story in the book about how they, one year during that 85 season or 84 season, they were in a situation where they were one run down, playing on the road, and for like two or three innings in a row, they got their leadoff man on, and they kept waiting for Yogi to bunt the runner over. And so the first inning comes, and, you know, they don't bunt the runner over, the guys do a double play. Next inning, they don't bunt the runner over, they got three outs in a row, fly ball, ground out. You know, next inning, the leadoff guy gets on, and somebody pipes up from down the row on the bench, one of the players, says, "Hey, Yogi, you going to make a move?" And Yogi looks at the guy, and he says, goes like this, he goes, "How's that for you?" Like that? I mean, he did things, he was unconventional, but, you know, I don't think anybody questions his baseball knowledge. Even today, he will make, you know, he will, I mean, I was with him for one of the book signing events that he and Ron did the first week that the book came out, and we were just sitting around, and again, you know, he's turning 87 in a couple of weeks, and, you know, his health is, I don't want to call it failing, but he's just moves very slow, but his mind is still sharp. We were coming out of spring training, he had been down there in early March, he was talking about you know, the guy, the new kid in the bullpen, you know, this kid, I like the way he works the count. I mean, he's still thinking the game. He's still, you know, he's still got a sharp mind. And there are people all around baseball who will tell you that when he was in Houston with, you know, what's his name? I'm drawing a blank on him. The kid who played, who came up as a catcher and wound up playing second base.
Biggio.
Biggio credits Yogi for, you know, helping him when he was a young catcher and also helping him as a young hitter. A lot of people, you know, really respect his knowledge. Now, whether it translated to being a great manager, hard to say. But the sample, you know, he was never around long enough to really have enough of a body of work. Oh, sorry about that. He loved Phil. They were very close. You know, they were both lived in New Jersey. Two Italian guys. And they co-owned a bowling alley in Clifton, New Jersey together during their playing and post-playing years called Berra-Rizzuto Lanes. And in fact, when Phil was, you know, in his final weeks and months, he was in the same nursing home that the Sopranos used for Tony's mom, you know, and Yogi would go every day to, he was the only one who had complete access to Phil. I mean, other than Phil's family, Yogi was the only person outside the family who could just walk in any time to see Phil. And he'd go every day and just tell him, they'd watch baseball, they'd sit and talk, they would have their little nip of vodka together. And right up until his death, and on YouTube there is a wonderful video of Yogi at Yankee Stadium on the day that Phil died. And the reporters wanted, of course, to talk to Yogi. And the Yankees brought Yogi out in the dugout. And he was very emotional. Yogi, I mean, you know, like George at the end of his life, you know, cried very easily. And so Joe Torre took it upon himself to sit with Yogi for the interview. And he spends the entire interview with his hand around Yogi's shoulder, with his arm around Yogi's shoulder, massaging his shoulder as Yogi is talking about Phil and pausing several times to getting choked up. But Yogi, you know, came through it and he said some wonderful things about Phil. But it's a beautiful video if you ever want to just, you know, Google it or just YouTube it.
Well, as you can, we're going to have to end the podcast here as far as the recording part of it. We don't have to end the night by any means. But as you can tell by Harvey's stories, this is a love story. And this book, Driving Mr. Yogi by Harvey Arradin, really honors everything that has come before, which is something we try to do here in the clubhouse. And Harvey did it so beautifully in this book. We'll be selling it here. To those listening on the podcast, you can find it everywhere. And please pick it up. It's a really beautiful read. And thank you so much, Harvey.